This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 7th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Today marks the 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan.
The United States has spent $228 billion.
We'll take a look at the cost of the war and the current state of the anti-war movement. We'll also speak to veterans trying to return to civilian life. These stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Thousands of workers from private and public sectors protested today in front of the seat of the Romanian government, blocking streets in the capital. They're angry about recent salary cuts levied by the government. The action follows a one-day strike earlier this week by nearly 1 million workers. FSRN's Donna Lepidot has this update from Bucharest.
This is how Romanian workers celebrated International Decent Work Day. Over 15,000 workers and union leaders protested for 3 hours in front of government buildings, shouting slogans and carrying signs critical of new employment policies. The workers protested recent cuts to salaries, mandatory unpaid furloughs, and thousands of layoffs. Currently, the unemployment rate is nearing 7%. Trade unionists hope to organize another, possibly longer, general strike and collected signatures of support at the protest. The unrest comes as the Romanian government is facing crisis. Last week, the coalition government broke down and a no-confidence vote that could dissolve the government is expected Monday. National elections are scheduled for the end of November. Dana Lepodat, FSRN, Bucharest, Romania.
Fears about disease and devastated food production are coming to pass today as Tropical Storm Parma continues to stall off the Philippines coast for the third day. The rains continue. 16 people have died in the storm so far, adding to the nearly 300 deaths caused by Tropical Storm Kitsana last week. Relief agencies say cases of diarrhea and other illnesses are becoming more prevalent. Almost 500,000 metric tons of rice crop have been lost in the flooding. The Philippines is the largest importer of rice in the world, but agriculture officials say so far the country has enough rice stockpiled to prevent a shortage. Cleanup and rescue operations continue in Indonesia today following last week's earthquakes. The death toll is estimated at least 1,000 people, but the Red Cross expects that number to be 3 times as high. Mike Penrose of Save the Children is on the ground near Padang, the city at the epicenter of the disaster. He says many families have been forced to live under tarps in the front yards of the destroyed homes.
It's raining quite regularly. There are a great number of children living with neighbors or in the front gardens of the houses that are destroyed in very bad conditions. So a number of health conditions can stem from that, including respiratory tract infections because they're having to sleep outside during the rain.
Save the Children says nearly half those affected in the disaster are children. Indonesian authorities are considering designating some of the razed villages as mass graves because of the number of people buried and the difficulty of digging out the bodies. Democrats are taking aim at a Supreme Court decision that makes it more difficult for victims of age discrimination to prove their cases. The Senate Judiciary heard testimony today and wants to lessen the burden of proof on victims of the bias. In other Supreme Court news, justices heard arguments today in the case of a nearly 80-year-old cross standing in Mojave National Preserve and whether the Christian symbol is a violation of separation of church and state. Shuhei Nakayama has more.
The cross was built in the 1930s as war memorial by the veterans of foreign wars. Former park employee Frank Buono filed the suit in 2001. After the Park Service denied a request to erect a Buddhist shrine near the cross. Buono, himself a Roman Catholic, argued that having cross on federal property violates First Amendment bans on the government's endorsement of one religion over another. After Buono and the ACLU won the initial case, Congress decided to transfer ownership of the land to a private owner. However, a federal appeals court ruled that was not a sufficient remedy. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility says that fight to keep the cross was just one of several attempts by the Bush administration to insert or maintain Christian imagery on public lands. The Obama administration has continued to argue that because the land is now private, there is no case. Some hope the decision will elucidate the Supreme Court's blurred approach to the First Amendment. But arguments today suggested that justice will only rule on a narrow range of issues. Shuhei Nakayama, Free Speech Radio News.
Republicans in the House have introduced a resolution calling for Representative Charlie Rangel to give up the chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee. This comes as the New York Democrat undergoes investigation for tax evasion and ethics violations. Democrats say no action should be taken until the Ethics Committee completes its investigation. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Charleston, South Carolina, I'm Jess Burns.
On this 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama is discussing the Afghanistan strategy with his national security team amidst requests from military officers and Republican lawmakers to increase troop numbers. As the president contemplates this decision, the American public is showing their concern. Two new polls reaffirm America's opposition to the Afghanistan war, especially an expansion of the war. A poll by Quinnipiac University says that just 38% of responders want President Obama to increase troops in Afghanistan, while a survey conducted by the Associated Press says less than half, or only 46%, support a troop increase. As the majority of Americans are growing more skeptical about the benefits of a heavy troop presence, peace groups have organized various demonstrations. But as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, protests are small, as anti-war activists are struggling to organize a strong opposition.
To commemorate the 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan in Washington, D.C., peace groups held an anti-war march and rally outside the White House Monday. 61 people were arrested. Local peace groups are holding local vigils across the country, and Peace Action West organized what they call a friendly takeover of the White House's Facebook page. Peace Action West says that one message per minute has been posted on the page opposing the war since Monday. Although the war is unpopular among Americans, public displays of opposition are lacking. For instance, at Monday's rally in D.C., only 300 people showed. That's a far cry from the hundreds of thousands who turned out for Iraq war demonstrations during the Bush administration, even when public opinion polls suggested that war was popular. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of Code Pink.
The majority of people are against the war in Afghanistan, and yet we don't have significant numbers of people out on the streets.
At its height, Code Pink had more than 200 local chapters across the country. Now, Benjamin says, only 90 are active. Activists cite a number of reasons for the low activist numbers. One is President Obama. Again, Medea Benjamin.
During the lead-up to the Obama campaign, a lot of local groups lost their members because they were focusing on the election.
Many anti-war activists supported Obama. He better represented the anti-war movement than Senator John McCain during the elections. Adrian Kenny is on the board of directors for Iraq Veterans Against the War.
I think that once we had the election, particularly since Obama had stated that he was for withdrawing troops from Iraq, and people weren't really thinking about Afghanistan then, that it's kind of took the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement.
Michael McPherson is president of Veterans for Peace. He says people are weary of endless opposition that lasted through the entire Bush presidency.
People are tired of being angry. You know, people want to be hopeful, and they want to work towards a goal rather than just being angry and in opposition.
Some anti-war groups didn't even oppose the war in Afghanistan. Iraq Veterans Against the War was split until they came out with a united policy of opposition just this year. Rebecca Griffin is the political director of Peace Action West.
There's a lot of confusion. A lot of people are a little bit torn because they've been hit with this idea that this is the good war, that this war is somehow linked to our security.
But as polls suggest, public opinion is changing on the war in Afghanistan. And activists say that as Obama contemplates an expansion of the war, now is the perfect time for activists to reengage. But they say their tactics have to change. They say anti-war protests can no longer be a campaign of opposition. Instead, they must be a campaign of alternatives. Rebecca Griffin says they have had to frame their message to their members so they are supportive of Obama.
Okay, you helped get President Obama elected. You supported him. This is a way to bolster him to make the right decision, to support him in making a smarter foreign policy, and to keep him from making a decision that's going to damage him and damage his presidency, as well as the security of the United States and of Afghanistan.
The same is true with members of other groups. Michael McPherson with Veterans for Peace says people don't look at Obama as destructive, like they might have with President Bush. So the focus cannot be on the person, McPherson says.
Because these things don't change that much from one person to the next. So let's be angry about the policy so we consistently demand policy change. And then people will start to think about, well, what is causing this stuff, and look deeper than just the personalities.
Protests and vigils will continue in some towns through this week. Activist leaders also urge their members to call Congress and the White House. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
As the war in Afghanistan rolls on, so do the problems and struggles of veterans who are trying to readjust to civilian life. FSRN's Karen Miller spoke to a group of veterans in Washington, D.C.
Genevieve Chase says when she came back from Afghanistan, she was surprised at what little help she received.
Well, when I checked out of the military base, when I out-processed, I filled out a form. I sat down with somebody for 5 minutes. I initialed boxes with lists of websites and phone numbers to call if I needed assistance, and I signed my name at the bottom of the page, and that was it. That was my out-briefing in terms of what my benefits were and what was available to me.
Upon returning, some veterans may be happy to be home at first, but then the real work begins. Abel Moreno is also an Afghanistan vet.
The reintegration process is just as hard, and it takes just as much tenacity to manage and govern as combat does.
Some vets say the first obstacle to that transition can be the organization that is supposed to help, the Veterans Administration. Again, Chase.
You still have to send a list of items to the VA to prove that you served. And I still find this exasperating. I don't understand why the Department of Defense systems and the VA medical systems or the VA system don't talk. Like why I enlisted into the military, why those records don't directly transfer over to the VA system. And that's still my biggest frustration.
Another problem for returning soldiers is recognizing and finding help for post-traumatic stress disorder. Retired Army Sergeant Braxton McCoy works with veterans through a program called Project Return to Work.
There's roadside bombs, suicide bombers, and that they're closed wound head injuries. You know, there's no physical, there's nothing on the outside to show what the problem really is. It's tougher to diagnose.
According to the RAND Corporation, 1 in 5 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans suffers from PTSD or major depression. And there were 110 active duty Army suicides from January through August of this year, according to the Defense Department. Again, McCoy.
Soldiers come home feeling like the only thing that they'll be good at ever again is just combat. Soldiers become detached and distant, and then once you start feeling distant, you can't. It's a very difficult road to get back.
Some soldiers say they just need someone to talk to make the transition easier. Veteran Genevieve Chase says she also needed peer support when she was going through a tough time.
I had too much time on my hands to think. You know, I didn't have soldiers to take care of anymore. I didn't have mentors to talk to every day. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a purpose. And that just spiraled into this kind of depression. And I explained it the other day. It was like walking along and falling in a well that I just didn't see. I just had no idea. And it just, all of a sudden, I'm in this well. And I saw the light. I saw that there was a way out, but I just didn't know how to get to it.
Female veterans who don't officially serve in combat roles often have a more difficult time finding support once they get home. Tia Christopher works with women veterans through a program called Swords to Plowshares based in San Francisco. She points out that women still see combat.
There's no front lines. So, you know, women are driving a convoy and their convoy, you know, hits an IED, you know, or they all of a sudden are ambushed, engaged in small arms fire. You have all these women in combat units. They're carrying guns. They end up being engaged in the combat, but they're usually not recognized for it.
According to Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, 7% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are women. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
On the 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, some public interest groups are using the occasion to raise awareness about the costs of the war. The National Priorities Project monitors war spending in Iraq and Afghanistan and calculates the wars will cost more than $1 trillion by March of next year. The New Hampshire-based organization says taxpayer dollars could do a lot more if spent on education, healthcare, housing, and other public goods and services. We're on the line now with the director of the National Priorities Project, Joe Comerford. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm really happy to be with you.
Joe, how much has the U.S. spent in the war in Afghanistan over the past 8 years?
To date, as of September 30th of 2009, the United States has spent $228 billion on the U.S. war in Afghanistan, $34 billion of it in 2009 alone.
What's this money being spent on? Is it on troops, on equipment, on contractors?
It's actually D, all of the above. The majority of the money is being spent to wage the war itself. So that's humans, whether they are military and or contracted employees, the ammunition, the weapons, the travel supplies needed to do it. Very, very little. Virtually less than 5% has been spent on what we call soft security. So that's aid and or diplomacy.
Now, Congress is considering a new defense bill at a price tag of $636 billion. Is this an increase from years past, or is the government finding ways to curb spending?
Actually, it is an increase, about 1.7%, which isn't a huge increase over last year, but I think it's meaningful, especially because the Obama administration has made a commitment to really look at defense spending, you know, to scrutinize it as it's not been looked at before, especially in the last 8 years. So I actually think that because we're increasing spending, that it is a meaningful increase, even 1.7%.
Is there any connection between the increases in military spending and the increased use of military contractors?
Every time a nation extends itself to the point that we've extended ourselves and doesn't have the resources, the human resources, to be able to do the kinds of jobs that need to be done when one is at war, we need to buy that service in from somewhere else. And so we do, in the form of contractors.
Now, your organization has done some cost comparisons and looks at the economic cost to communities, the economic cost of the war. What are communities losing with such a big war budget, and how do you calculate this?
It's a good question. We have, over the years, developed very good methodologies to both understand the number vis-a-vis tax dollars and then understand it vis-a-vis local costs for things that we call trade-offs. And what we mean by trade-offs is that there are things in our lives, like teachers or infrastructure or healthcare, that help us understand security at a different level and help us understand what our community needs could be met, what community needs could be met by investing in some of these sectors. So, for example, the cost of war since 2001 to U.S. taxpayers, we know, is $228 billion. That's the Afghanistan war. For that same amount of money, our nation could have provided 800,000 four-year university scholarships for our students. As we go lower, again, this is lower in NPP terms, that's what we talk about when we go to the state level. If we're looking at a place like New York State, New York State taxpayers share of the Afghanistan war spending is $20.5 billion. $20.5 billion of federal tax dollars have left New York State since 2001 and have gone to this war spending. And so we actually can get lower than that and say that that $20.5 billion, using cost figures in New York State, could have also produced for the state 116,000 affordable housing units. Or they could have produced 300,000 teachers, music teachers or art teachers. And then when we look at both the housing shortage and the need for more teachers in our schools, again, that number gets magnified. You know, we want to look at it more. We want to understand as a people what $20.5 billion means.
That was Joe Comerford from the National Priorities Project speaking about war spending in Afghanistan and Iraq, the cost to taxpayers, and the trade-offs. If you'd like to see spending figures for your state or your city, you can visit NPP's website at www.nationalpriorities.org. For nearly a decade, FSRN has brought you news from more than 200 reporters across six continents.
In the jungle province of Choco.
Workers at SK Hand Tools in Chicago.
Yes, I can give you specific figures.
Thousands prepared to take to the streets once again.
At a time when newspapers are downsizing and closing their international bureaus, FSRN continues to bring you on-the-ground and in-depth coverage from global hotspots like the Gaza Strip and the tribal belt of Pakistan. You hear the voices of everyday people sharing their challenges and struggles, their resourcefulness and determination.
This needed to really be a call to action.
Iran deserves to have a democracy. We will get closer to that goal.
And we're making our stand here.
That's how I feel exactly, you see.
Reporting that's critical in understanding how policymakers affect citizens at home and abroad. Your support of FSRN goes a long way in building and strengthening our international coverage. Visit fsrn.org to learn more about how you can help. In Colombia, law enforcement authorities are prosecuting three men for the murder of 12 indigenous Awá people in August. Colombian Defense Minister Gabriel Silva spoke about the case Tuesday, shortly after the suspects were captured by police officers in the Southwest Nariño department.
The people who committed this horrible crime are members of a band called Los Cucarachos. They are also members of the Awá ethnic group. They had been operating in that region as common delinquents and hitmen. They had been running drug trafficking operations in the region. They're under investigation for other crimes in the department of Nariño, such as participating in massacres, kidnappings, and extortion.
Colombian newspaper El Tiempo reports an informant tipped off the police, saying the men massacred the 12 Awá Indians in August because they wanted to silence a witness to a previous crime. The Colombian defense minister said one of the detained men is a former member of the FARC. The guerrilla group has been involved in previous massacres of indigenous people in southwest Colombia. FARC are currently negotiating the exchange of some 20 military hostages with Colombian authorities. More than 4,200 people have been kidnapped by the FARC over the last 15 years. Currently, more than 700 are held captive. These people have no way to contact their families, and many are held by the FARC for years. But one activist is doing all he can to connect these captives with their relatives. Voces del Secuestro, or Voices of the Kidnapped, is a radio program that's been aired every Sunday for more than a decade. FSRN's Natalia Viana has the story.
When the former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt gained her freedom after 6 years of captivity by the FARC, one of the first things she did was greet a journalist. In her first press conference, she called Colombian radio presenter Erbin Hoyos and told him, "You are my brother forever." For thousands of people who've been kidnapped and taken captive by the FARC, Erbin Hoyos is probably Colombia's most important radio host.
We are praying for all of you. Do not lose faith in a prompt release.
Just after midnight every Sunday morning, Hoyos presents the program Voces del Secuestro. The program began in 1994 and is aired by Caracol Radio, one of Colombia's most popular stations. The show is broadcast late at night because it's created specifically for FARC captives. It's resting time for the guerrillas and the hostages who often walk the entire day through the forest. Hoyos starts every program with the same request. I respectfully ask the kidnappers to let the prisoners tune in the radio. For him, the program provides the hope the captives need to remain alive.
Contra todo eso, contra el dolor, contra el sufrimiento.
It's a program against pain, against suffering. When we bring them a program like this, with messages from their loved ones, they are immunized for another week. Then the following week, we air another program, and they are immunized for another week. Then the following week, we air another program, and they are immunized again. And we have been doing this week after week, for 14 years and counting.
Y así, han pasado 14 años y aquí seguimos.
Hoyos had the idea for the program when he himself was kidnapped by the FARC in 1994. A long-time hostage complained that Colombian journalists did nothing for them. The program has provided a bridge between hostages and their families ever since.
Hijo, hace dos años te sacaron de...
Son, it's been years since you were taken from us. I remember the anguish and the uncertainty and the despair in not being able to find you and the powerlessness of having to wait without doing anything as the days went by.
Hoyos says over the years he has grown close to the families of those held captive.
There is a strong relationship because I am a means by which to reach the kidnapped. So there is an excellent relationship. Of course, taken in perspective, I'm a journalist and they are the relatives, but this doesn't make me indifferent to feeling what they feel because I've been there myself.
Relatives call in and share news about new babies, recent marriages, and how the kids are doing in school. They also send messages of love and hope through the airwaves. Each broadcast receives over 300 calls. The messages usually last up to 1 minute, but many people line up in front of the Radio Caracol studios in the north of Bogotá to record their greetings in person. That's the case with Miriam Mora and her husband Rafael. Their eldest son, Juan Camilo, has been held by the FARC since 2006. The then 24-year-old accountant was kidnapped in Bogotá by guerrillas dressed as police. His parents have not heard from him since, but come to Radio Caracol every week to send their message.
It's a commitment we have with our son, for him to know that we are here thinking of him with our hearts, so he never thinks we abandon him.
I usually improvise the message each week. Whatever comes from my heart is what I tell my son every late night.
Former hostages say the program played a very important role in their lives, and relatives say it's a way to relieve their suffering.
I feel tranquil and in peace because one can carry lots of emotions, and to know that he is listening leaves us calm. To know he is aware that we are following his situation, and he is in our hearts, and that we haven't forgotten.
Una vez le transmitimos el mensaje,
we feel peace after sending our messages, a great relief because we say, well, Juan knows we are here and he can count on us and that we are waiting for him every minute of every day.
Every week, Erbin Hoyos ends his program with the same promise. He says Voces del Secuestro will stop airing when the FARC releases their last hostage. With assistance from Manuel Rueda, I'm Natalia Viana in Bogotá, Colombia.
And that's all for today's program. You're listening to FSRN. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Jess Burns. From Bogotá, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.